Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls. All around the world today, there are people speaking some variety of English. Now, for a lot of people, that is their primary language, but for others, it is an additional language, and it is something that for them is an important tool when talking business or politics or popular culture. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking a little bit about the spread of English, about the way that it has influenced other languages, perhaps in turn the ways that other variants of English have influenced both British and American English. And we have here in the studio with us two guests, both people who have done a lot of writing and research in this particular area, this area of linguistics, Kingsley Bolton and Yamuna Khatru. Kingsley Bolton is professor of English linguistics at Stockholm University. He is here visiting the campus to spend a few days, and he'll be giving a talk. In fact, this is the inaugural Braj and Yamuna Khatru Distinguished Lecture in the Linguistic Sciences here at the U of I. And the lecture, taking place on Thursday, is titled World Englishes in the Global Context, and that's 7:30. In room 210 of the Illini Union on West Green, and it's open to anybody who would like to attend. And we're also pleased to have here with us Yamuna Khatru. She is a professor emerita of linguistics here at the U of I. She has been here at the University of Illinois since 1965 and is someone, along with her partner, who has been involved in doing a lot of writing about this very subject, about world Englishes. And if you're not sure what we mean by that, well, I'll ask them to explain. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Any point here, people who are listening are certainly welcome to call. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Was it indeed you or Braj who coined that term, world Englishes? Does one of you get credit for that?
It's Braj Khatru and Larry Smith of East West Center Hawaii, who first thought of pluralizing the English language into world Englishes. And this happened around 1978.
Mm-hmm. So what do you mean by that? When you say world Englishes, what exactly does that mean?
I think that that's a recognition of the fact that there is no single dominant variety of the English language. A good example of that would be American English. And in fact, if you go back and look at the book by Mencken, The American Language, which I think was published originally in 1919, then in the introduction, the preface to that, Mencken says, well, when I first started on this endeavor, people asked me, why are you talking about American English? Surely there's just one variety of English. And Mencken went ahead and published the American language, and that was, if you like, gave American English its recognition, its solid recognition. Of course, there had been work earlier by Noah Webster and even Benjamin Franklin and others. So I think Mencken was the last in a long tradition in striving for the recognition of American English. Mm-hmm. So we can even then we had there was a plural recognition of the fact that there's more than one variety of English, and moving on from that, I think into the sort of modern era, in the era after the Second World War, then there's been recognition of other varieties of English, such as Australian English, which until 1980 lacked its own national dictionary, but then in 1980. The Macquarie Dictionary of Australian English was published, and that gave recognition to Australian English. And around that time, people began to be interested in not only British American and Australian English, but also the other varieties of English that had developed in the world, such as in the Asian region, we have Indian English, Singapore English, Philippine English, even Hong Kong English, and so on.
Mm-hmm. And so what we're talking about is something that that might have begun because English speakers went out and settled in various places like Australia or Canada or the United States. some of it is the result of the colonial project, so that might not have been a choice of indigenous people to be suddenly having to function in English. But it gets beyond that, that people have as a matter of choice. There are more people who have adopted English as a lingua franca, that is for as a way of speaking to somebody else whose first language is not English. But if you have two people who speak different languages, they've got to find some way that they can to speak to one another. And it may be that English has come to fulfill that role.
Actually, this is partly true, that English developed varieties because English speakers moved to other areas of the world, such as Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the USA. But a large part of it is, as you mentioned, because of the colonial spread. But later, it also happened that some of the English-speaking powers came to dominate politically and otherwise areas of the world because of victories in World War II or whatever. And that led to areas of influence of English-speaking people. And that, for example, is responsible for the displacement of Spanish from the Philippines, in some sense, and the exposure to English in a big way in Japan. So this also happened. So this is not because of the English speakers moving into these areas. It's more that there was a political influence, and later it became economic influence. And, of course, you know, that's how, because of political, economic, business, commerce, and diplomatic reasons, many areas of the world found it to be beneficial to them to operate in English. And so the impetus for adopting English now does not come from English speakers. It comes from the local populations in South Asia, East Asia, Southeast Asia, Africa, and other regions of the world.
And it's viewed as a matter of necessity as a communications tool. If you're going to communicate in the world of politics or the world of business or perhaps the world of science, and I imagine also that popular culture, the spread of American popular culture, also facilitates that.
I think that's correct. One way of looking at English today worldwide is that it's no longer regarded as a language, quote unquote, but it's regarded as a basic skill. So if you send your children to school in many parts of the world, then what is it you want them to learn? You want them to learn the national language, whatever that is. You'd like them to learn mathematics. You'd like them to learn computers. You'd like them to, or expect them to learn English. In many parts of the world, knowing English today is a sign of being educated. And in school systems worldwide, the age at which children now are beginning to learn English has decreased very rapidly. So even in China today, I think it's national education policy that all children from the age of 5 onwards will start learning English. So it's becoming a basic skill in education that should be learned rather than a foreign language. It's something that you learn when you go mm-hmm. go to school as part of being educated, I think. And there's a good deal of evidence that this process will continue for the next 50 years worldwide and then peak, and then in 50 years' time, perhaps, it will be, at least in education systems, English will be sort of firmly established as a skill that is learnt at a relatively very early age. The other issue, which you touched on just now, David, about popular culture, I think is very interesting, mm-hmm. because in the context of popular culture, the variety of English, which is being transported mm-hmm. worldwide, is obviously that of American English. And there's a long history to that. And a great deal is connected with the popularity of Hollywood. I mean, from the 1930s, from the talkies onwards, or even from the silent era, where you have actually intertitles between different scenes in films written in American English and so on. People in Britain complained at the time, actually, that this was written in the American jargon. But the American jargon, for better or worse, seems to be transported around the world through all the popular media that have been developed in Hollywood and in Silicon Valley and so on. So you have not only films and television, you also have video games, you have the internet and so on. And I think that this is having an impact on youth culture worldwide.
Yeah. Just one further point, I think this is true, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong about this, that if you look at these different spheres in which English is spoken and compare that, the one that I live in, where I'm here living in the United States, English is the predominant language. It's the only one that I have. And compare that with other places where English is an additional language, that those folks who speak English that way, there are more of them than there are people for whom it is their first language, is their predominant language. That's right?
That's correct. And actually now that's what has been observed in the literature also. Because if you take just a very conservative view, there are at least 330 million people in India alone who have some English proficiency. Mm-hmm. And then if you add to that more than 200 million people in China who claim to be proficient in English, then that is already much more than the entire population of the English-speaking world, including the USA, Britain, Canada, and all the others. Mm-hmm. So, and also, as we have pointed out in literature, the creative impulses are now coming from non-English-speaking world in English literature. So many of the major literary prizes have been awarded to writers from Africa, from South Asia, from Southeast Asia, and so on, and the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And I want to add one more point to the point that Kingsley just made about popular culture. It is true that it is American English that is dominating in popular culture, but we probably should remember that American English, in its turn, is influenced a great deal by Caribbean and what we call here African-American dialects of English. So as it is, the English that we hear in popular culture has a mix already of what we will call world Englishes.
Yeah. We have two guests with us in the studio. Just very quickly, let me introduce them again. And we have a caller who'd like to join in the conversation. Kingsley Bolton is professor of English linguistics at Stockholm University. Grew up and was educated in Britain and then did a lot of his academic work in Hong Kong, right, before going to Sweden.
Yes, that's
and also here in the studio with us is Yamuna Kachru. She's professor emerita of linguistics here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. She's been here since 1965. This subject, world English, is something that both of them have written quite a bit about. And Kingsley Bolton is here to give a talk on this subject, world Englishes in the global context. This is the inaugural Braj and Yamuna Kachru Distinguished Lecture in the Linguistic Sciences at the U of I. In honor of both our guest here and her husband, who have been here at the university for, both of them now retired, their emeriti here at the University of Illinois, and have done work, and both of them done work in this area, been doing it for quite a long time. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have a caller to talk with, someone over in Indiana. So this is line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering if you can say anything, I mean anything, in relationship to Greek during that period of the Hellenistic Empire and all that sort of stuff, where those entanglements of languages occurred. Are there any predictive sources, anything hard evidence, math kind of thing that you can, you know, squeeze out of anything, or any general concepts that you can sort of tie all these things together? Thanks.
Yeah, okay. Is that something that you can talk about?
One source that you might like to look at is a recent book called Empires of the Word by a gentleman called Osner, I believe. Ostler, sorry, I correct myself, yeah. Ostler. And he discusses, from a historical perspective, various linguistic, for want of a better word, empires of the past, including Arabic, including Greek, including Latin, and so on. And it's a very scholarly and fascinating account. So I think actually that might be one source you might turn to. I hope that helps.
Is what has happened now with English, is that a process that we have essentially seen before with these other languages, or is there something that's significantly different about the way that English has spread and the way that it's now used?
Actually, it has happened quite a bit in the past, with, for example, in the Asian case, with Sanskrit, which spread first of all over India and then into Southeast Asia. And it happened with Persian during the Mughal period, when Persian became virtually the language of administration and legal system all over South Asia. Mm-hmm. And then it has happened with Arabic. So this, the only difference with English is because of the rapid industrialization and rapid advances in technology, it has become much easier to have a language spread all over the world rather than in their own domains, regional domains. For example, Sanskrit had impact only in South and Southeast Asia, and to some extent, some of its dialect, because of Buddhism, went into China. But it didn't really have that impact in China that it had on Southeast Asian languages, such as Thai. Arabic had influence because of spread of Islam, but that also remained because it's a classical language and it was so heavily associated with the spiritual domain. It did not become a general language of people. With English, there were no such constraints. And therefore, English became much more widely spread all over the world.
And I suppose that makes one wonder that if English comes to fulfill this function, and if it does a good job doing that, then is it likely that some other language is going to come along and displace it? Or do you think that as long as English continues to do that and everybody's sort of satisfied, and I suppose it does have something to do with the dominance of the United States in geopolitics, whether it's likely that another language, I don't know what language it would be, another language might come along and displace English and then take over that function.
Well, I think you've touched on the answer there, David. I mean, it is we're living in the American age, and typically one of the explanations for the spread of English after the Second World War was the rise of American power worldwide, American political power and economic power, and so on. And so, I think that essentially the key to that question or the key to that answer is political. If one could imagine a world in which, for example, China became all dominant in the sphere of economic and development and political power, then one would expect the numbers of people learning Chinese to rise very rapidly in the world.
At the same time, Chinese being an extraordinarily difficult language to learn, you would think, well, how likely is it that something like that, which has a very complicated tonal system that you have to learn and very complicated writing system, I mean, if you're going to read it in Chinese characters, that's really, really tough. I'm sure it's difficult enough to learn English because it has some screwy rules to it too, but it's nothing like trying to learn Chinese.
I think many Chinese speakers would agree with you on that point, actually. So. But nevertheless, I think that for the title of Osler's book, "Empires of the Word," is not chosen by accident. Yeah. That language does follow political power, or has done historically.
Political and economic. Now we have to add.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. How many different variants, and I know using the word variant might be problematic within linguistics. I'll just use that word as a layperson.
Yeah.
How many different variants of English are there?
Actually, I don't think anybody has really counted the numbers. But the prominent ones, if you can ignore some of the local variations. For example, let me illustrate it with an example which would perhaps make it clear. Hmm. We talk in general of American English. Actually, there is nothing like American English. There are at least, according to Walt Wolfram, there are 18 dialects of American English. So which one is American English? And similarly, if we go by the published literature, there are at least 13 dialects of British English. So when we talk about American English or British English, we are talking about an idealization in terms of what we perceive as standard or general American English and standard British English. So if you go by that kind of concept, then I would say that we have Canadian English, Australian English, New Zealand English, and all of these grammars and dictionaries have been published recently. Then you have the Caribbean English. There's a long tradition of dictionary making in Caribbean English. Within Caribbean, you have Jamaican English. Then you have Nigerian English, which is well established in Africa and South Asia as an area, but within that you have varieties like Indian English and Pakistani English and Sri Lankan English. So it's very difficult to enumerate all Englishes. And then if you go to what we call the expanding circle, then within the expanding circle you can talk about Hong Kong English, on which Kingsley has done a lot of work, China English or Chinese English, and Japanese English, Korean English. So it's difficult to enumerate how many varieties, but all the local varieties exist side by side, these labeled varieties such as British English and American English and Canadian English and so on.
I think one of the achievements of the World English's approach to the study of English worldwide has been to recognize localized varieties of English around the world as worthy of investigation, worthy of description in their own right, whereas previously, up to, say, the 1950s or 1960s, the standard argument from a number of British linguists or American linguists was that people out there in the rest of the world spoke English incorrectly and needed to be schooled in the correct manner of speaking. Mm-hmm. So, which is a rather condescending attitude. So I think a major achievement of the World English's approach has actually been recognizing the distinctiveness of local varieties of English around the world, and the fact that these have their own histories, and these histories are very interesting, and that also at the same time there's something that to be learned there about linguistics and about English linguistics by looking at these local varieties around the world.
Let's talk with someone else in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, I used to go to a church in Peoria. They had a lot of famous speakers come from around the world, and one of them was Dr. Stanley Collins. And he said he'd like to come to Peoria once per year, if for no other reason than to reteach us the King's English. And he was from Britain. So my question is, what is the King's English? And is there still a certain pride within Great Britain English is their language, and while other dialects may be fine, the original is spoken this way?
I guess that question goes to me.
I think you'll have to take that one.
So, I don't know. I think there probably are a few linguistic conservatives left in the UK, although there's a high level of awareness in the UK that there are a whole range of different dialects within Britain. And there's an interest in those dialects and a tolerance of those dialects. In recent years, the King's English, which was essentially that variety of English, or that the idealized variety of English spoken by members of the royal family and so on, often it would also be called the Queen's English. there's been evidence in recent years that this has actually lost prestige, that has lost status. I mean, this is a process that has been going on since the 1960s when you had a medical doctor's son called Mick Jagger on television and on radio speaking with something like a Cockney accent, whether it was assumed or not. So he would tend to speak like this, even though he was a well-educated young man. He would tend to speak in the Cockney dialect. And later, there was even evidence that Princess Diana, in fact, there was one description of the speech of Princess Diana, and it was noticed that she'd adopted certain Cockney features in her speech, including a medial glottal stop, as linguists call it, which is the sound in butter and better and so on. So there's... The standard explanation is that actually the Queen's English or King's English has competed for prestige in recent years with a more popular accent in southern England, which is often referred to as the Cockney accent or something like it.
That's good. What does George Bush speak, by the way?
I think that question will have to go to Yamuna.
A modified version of, I would say, Texas English.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We're talking about world Englishes, that is, the many varieties of English that are spoken around the world, and how the use of English has grown around the world. We have two guests, both of them linguists who have done a lot of writing in this area. Kingsley Bolton is professor of English linguistics at Stockholm University, and Yamuna Khatru is professor emerita of linguistics here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Professor Bolton is here to give a talk on the subject World Englishes in the Global Context. This is in honor of Braj and Yamuna Khatru. It's the inaugural Braj and Yamuna Khatru Distinguished Lecture in Linguistic Sciences taking place on Thursday, 7:30 in the evening at the Illini Union, room 210. And it's free and open to the public. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. And questions here are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. One of the things I'm interested in is of these various varieties of English that people are speaking around the world, how different they are one from another. And if we got together a group of people, we had someone from Canada and someone from Britain and someone from the United States and someone from Jamaica and someone from Nigeria and someone from Beijing and someone from Bangalore, and we got them all together in a room and just got them to engage in conversation, would they in fact be able to understand one another, or would there be some difficulties?
They will be able to understand one another to some extent. There will be some difficulties because what the research has shown, there is a great deal of research on what we call intelligibility in English. And what the research has shown is that it takes a little time to get used to the various accents, which of course are different from the other parts of language. The accent is the phonetic sounds that we hear and the rhythm that we hear in speech. That takes time to get used to. And then, of course, the characteristic way of using lexical items, that is words, and syntactic patterns, that is sentence patterns that people use. So it does take a little time. Let me just give you a very small example. When I first heard a lecture on general linguistics, because I learned English as a written and language, and as a language to be read in books, I did not speak English when I was learning English in India in schools. So when I first heard an English speaker speak in the class, and he was an American English speaker who came from Canada but was teaching at Cornell University, Professor Fairbanks, and he kept talking about something called writing system. And I kept wondering, what has writing system got to do with language? It took me a while to understand that what he was doing was flapping the middle T, the intervocalic T as we call it in linguistics, in order to sound, which to my ears, I perceived it as some kind of a D. So he was talking about writing system, but I interpreted it as writing system. It took me at least 15 seconds, and listening to him three times pronounce the word during the course of lecture to figure out he was talking about writing system. So this is just a very small example, but this is the kind of thing that can happen. And the more people are exposed to various accents, the more it becomes easy for them to follow other accents and other ways of interaction. And so there is a great deal of research in this area.
Well, clearly there are differences in the way different people pronounce the same words, and local vocabularies are different. Different people have different words for the same thing. So that's also, you'd have to learn that one person, they're calling something one thing, and we don't call it that, but as long as you understand, oh, I know what it is you're talking about. But then at a deeper level, if you're talking about things like word order, how you put words together in a sentence, or basic rules about language, do these different Englishes differ in that way? Is there something that goes beyond pronunciation and vocabulary to a more deeper structure?
Well, just to follow up on the last question, and just adding to what Yamuna said, I think that one interesting fact is that where they've actually looked at a situation that you described, where you have people from all over the world in the same room, there's a cooperative element to communication in those contexts. People will avoid local idioms. I don't know. I mean, if I was to talk to a group of American undergraduates and use the expression, "Well, he bowled a googly when he asked me that question," they would probably have little idea of what I was talking about. So I would probably avoid that expression, and so on and so forth, which is the equivalent, I suppose, in American English of throwing you a curved ball.
Okay. I know it has something to do with cricket. I wasn't exactly sure what. Yeah.
In international context, then, I think there would be an avoidance. We all change the way we're speaking according to our interlocutors, the people we're speaking to or speaking with. And so I think that there's a cooperative principle that functions here. But when it comes to the description of localized varieties of English around the world, then, and there are a number of criteria that are often referred to in this context. If we're talking about what is a local variety of English, one criterion would be accent. Is there an identifiable local pronunciation? A second criterion would be vocabulary. Is there a local word stock that is distinctive of that particular area? A third criterion would be history. Is there a history of English in that particular locality? Which is very interesting, actually. If we consider that Indian English, for example, and even English in China, dates from around the same time as the development of American English.
That's right.
Really?
Really.
That's right.
Yeah. So, because this was the age of exploration, the age of European exploration, and so on and so forth. Another aspect of a local variety would be creative writing. Is there creative writing in that particular variety? And as Yamuna mentioned earlier, one of the features of the Booker Prize and even the Nobel Prize in the last two decades has been that writers from the Caribbean, Africa, and Asia have been winning those prizes. So we're not just talking about quote unquote Peter Sellers English or funny varieties of English, but we're talking about some of the best literature in the English language today. And then the fifth criterion would be, are there reference works? Are there descriptions of these localized varieties? So these five criteria give us, I think, a guide to identifying local varieties of English around the world.
Hmm. And to answer your question directly, yes, there are syntactic differences also, especially in the use of aspect tense forms, and in the use of articles. English article system is notoriously ill-defined in terms of its syntactic as well as semantic properties. So it's not very easy to explain in grammar books exactly how people should use articles. So it's something that is difficult to teach. It's very difficult for people to get a hold of. Mm-hmm. If they come from a different system where the distinctions in terms of indefinite, definite, and specific, non-specific is made in different terms. So there are syntactic variations, but what is fascinating is that there are variations in terms of what we call speech acts, that is, using language to do things. For example, issuing commands, making requests, expressing condolence or expressing appreciation, thanking somebody, expressing gratitude. In those, conventions differ according to the local norms. And so that can create sometimes a little bit of misunderstanding and some problems. But usually, once you get used to your interlocutor's way of doing things, then it becomes easier. And as long as all interlocutors have open mind, as we usually have in, say, academic gatherings and so on, or graduate students when they get together in the common rooms, or undergraduate students interact with each other, as long as people have open mind, they seem to come to understand each other's way of doing things.
We have someone else to talk with, someone who is here in Champaign County, where we are. This is our line two. Hello.
Thank you for an interesting program. The six criteria really should be denotation and connotation, and the changes that may take place, and because of regional or national differences and understandings. You sort of just briefly touched on that just now. Is there more to that? Is that something within your purview?
I'm not quite sure how you are using the words denotation and connotation.
Well, simply do the meanings of words change in different Englishes? That should be noted and that make different Englishes unique and special.
Yes, they do, to some extent. Not all of the words change their meaning, but there are some words that do. And you are right, even between American English and British English, and these have been, there have been jokes about it, and there have been quite a bit of research on this topic, and there are some special dictionaries that have been published for American visitors to Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So,
surely,
So there are differences.
Do these differences become greater in different cultures? Vastly different cultures.
Well, I think if I can jump in there, just to give one or two examples. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way in which you use yard. Mm. In American English, I think, which would be equivalent to garden. Mm. So a yard in Britain can usually refers to a paved area outside an office block, or it could be an exercise yard in an army barracks. But I think in American usage, am I correct? It often refers to what we would call in British English the garden. The area at the back of the house.
The backyard. Hmm.
The backyard.
The front yard.
Another example from Australian English would be the word bush. A bush in Britain is a small tree. In Australia, it's any rural area outside a city. In Philippine English, they use the word province to refer to anywhere outside the capital city, Manila, and so on and so forth. Very often in context of world Englishes, we have examples of what is referred to as semantic shift, a change of meaning, and local usages of that kind.
Mm-hmm.
So your question about the semantics of vocabulary and so on is well taken. It's a good point, I think.
Could you do a popular review of a movie by the title of Spanglish? Are you familiar with that?
Was that a film with Adam Sandler or... was it perhaps not? But I don't actually. I've got to confess, I haven't seen the film.
That's
I don't know
right.
If Yamuna has.
No, I haven't seen the film. Yeah, but there are movies that I have seen which use Indian English the same way, what we call Hinglish.
Yes.
And I have seen some of those, but I haven't seen the Spanglish one.
Now, is this sort of combined? English kind of term indicative of a a full-fledged English is variety?
It's difficult to judge that at this point, because if we go back in history, at some point when just after Norman conquest, perhaps English went through that stage when there was a great deal of importation of Romance words into English. And it took centuries for that form of English to stabilize, which gives English its characteristics as opposed to other Germanic languages.
So I need to wait centuries for my answer.
Yes. I would suggest
so
that we have to wait for that.
All right.
Yes.
Well, thank you. We have just about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guests are Yamuna Kachru. She is Professor Emerita of Linguistics here at the University of Illinois, and Kingsley Bolton. He's Professor of English Linguistics at Stockholm University. And we're talking about the various kinds of English that are spoken around the world and just how that has grown. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller raised a question that was in my mind as well, because we certainly know that there are many languages around the world that have taken English words into their language, some more enthusiastic than others, and there are some places where they've tried very hard, where the powers that be have tried very hard to prevent that from happening, who have said, oh, that's a terrible thing, all this English coming into our language. But it certainly does happen. And it was in my mind this question, well, are there ways in which English, it's more than just adding new words into a language, whether English has actually changed the way those people speak their own language or use their own language?
It depends on how familiar American English or British English or Canadian English speakers are with other languages. But in speaking in general terms, if you take certain terms that have come into English language and which are being used very, very frequently now, and for example, the word mantra, you hear it all the time. Mantra, of course, comes from Sanskrit, and it came via Indian English into British English and from there into other Englishes. Mantra originally meant a chant, but it had a spiritual purpose. It did not mean what it means now, which is a meaningless repetition of certain kinds of phrases. Or take the expression juggernaut. Juggernaut has a long history, and it comes from, again, the Indian expression Jagannath, which is the Lord of the Universe, which is one of the incarnations of Lord Vishnu. And the way these words come into English and get reinterpreted adds certain kinds of meanings to the English language which it did not have before. Mm-hmm. So that way it expands what we call the meaning potential of the language. And one can give examples from Mencken's discussion of the English language, the American language, where he shows how many items have been taken from American Indian or Native American languages and also from Spanish. What we call now American English has elements of African American, Spanish, and American Indian languages. For example, expressions such as butte, okay, which did not exist in British English because there was no concept of that particular geographical feature. So, in a sense, when we import words into a language, sometimes the word just exists side by side with the native words and gets specialized into a narrower range of meaning. But sometimes it adds new meanings to the language. So it does change the language in very subtle ways.
And I think the other side of your question, am I right, David, was what impact does English have on other languages around the world?
Yes, but I think both of these are really interesting interesting questions. That was kind of what I was thinking about that too. That is, you know, for people who are whose first language is, I don't know what, Hindi or Chinese or whatever, the greater presence of English, does that change the way that they approach their own language?
Well, I think there are a number of levels to that. I mean, one important area is vocabulary. And if we look at many parts of the world, English has been the language of modernity for many parts of the world. So a large number of lexical items, vocabulary items, are borrowed in to whichever language we're talking about from English. Also, there are other changes that may occur in the language as well, syntactic or discoursal changes related to the processes of translation, whereby large amounts of information are translated into. For example, I think in East Asian languages such as Japanese and Korean, there have been studies here at Urbana-Champaign of the way in which there have been syntactic changes within Japanese and Korean as a result of massive translation from English into those languages.
Also in Chinese.
Yes.
And also Indian languages. Indian languages, of course, there has been a long contact, so there has been many, many changes. And one area which is very interesting is certain new genres of literature have developed in modern Indian languages which did not exist before. So medieval Indian literature and ancient Indian literature are basically verse-based. So our poetry was very developed, poetic genres, but prose genres were not very well developed. Mm. So in the modern sense of fiction, or in the modern sense, the one-act plays and those kinds of genres, they developed as a result of contact with English and other European languages that was translated into English. But all the influences that came into Indian literature, for example, the entire movement of progressive literature, which is the Marxist literature, that came contact with Russian and French, but the Russian and French very few people knew, but the works that were translated into English became the main source for those.
We have enough time, certainly, if someone wants to join in, if they want to call very quickly. We have a couple of minutes left, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. I'm also very interested in the idea of the ways that perhaps other languages or other varieties of English are changing English in a larger sense, and maybe just because I'm here in the United States, my focus is on American English. Mm-hmm. But you said something I thought very, very interesting early on, Professor Akatru, that and I think certainly people would acknowledge the in variety of ways African American English has influenced speech and popular culture. In some cases, perhaps also Caribbean English. Do you think that there will be other ways in which these other Englishes will continue to feed back to and perhaps affect how people in the United States or in Britain or Canada or Australia, places like that, speak English?
Well, I think that, there is a much greater, for example, in Britain, there's a much greater awareness, I think, of Indian English and other varieties of Asian English. And part of that has been cultural, the popularity in recent years of Bollywood films and various other aspects of popular South Asian culture and so on. And not to mention the fact that there is a sizable South Asian community within Britain and so on. So I think that this process of language contact and language change does go both ways. And I think now in the United States you have writers like Juno Diaz, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, who's just written a prize-winning novel. Was it The Short Life of Oscar Wilde? But it's a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel where there's a wide use of Spanish throughout the whole novel, which is juxtaposed with English and largely left it unexplained. It's not glossed into English, but there's a sort of hybrid Spanglish, for want of a better word, that is used throughout the novel. So there are these changes, and I think one of the areas of debate in the United States, I'm speaking as an outsider, is about the effect of Spanish on American English.
Well, this is something that interests me as well, and I don't know, you might feel that that's a little outside of the area in which you work, but certainly I have had this as a question. As we have more and more people living in the United States who speak Spanish, is that going to have some kind of – you would have to think it could not help, given time and numbers. It could not help but have some influence on the way that English was spoken in the United States.
Actually, there has been a lot of influence of Spanish if you go back to the American language again. You know,
certainly in terms of vocabulary.
Yeah, vocabulary there has. And I'm sure that if one does a survey of this West Coast English now, there probably would be a greater impact of Spanish there, or wherever there are Spanish-speaking populations, the density of the population is greater, there would be some impact, and then it would definitely reflect, I have a feeling, over the years in the way American English works.
We're coming down to the point here. We just have to finish, and maybe we really only have about a minute or so left. Do there remain for you a lot of interesting questions yet to be answered about this subject that we've been talking about?
Absolutely, and I think that one thing that we haven't had time to discuss really is the reactions to English and attitudes to English throughout the world, because we've been talking about this because we're interested in this subject, we've done research in this subject and so on and so forth, but I think it's also worth mentioning that the issue of English and the spread of English is also a cause of concern out there in the world. In the year 2000, I think the total number of languages spoken in the world was calculated to be 6,000 languages. But in the next 50 years, it's estimated that 5,000 of those languages are going to disappear. We'll be left with 1,000 languages only. And there are a lot of questions about the role that English is playing worldwide, whether or not it's if you like, a force for good, or whether it's, as it's been called, a killer language. So that's something we haven't had a chance to discuss. And I think debates about English will continue. But it seems set that English will continue to spread, at least for the foreseeable future, because most people in the world actually want to know English, or they want their children to know English.
We're going to have to stop. We're going to have to leave it at that. But I do want to say that for people in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you would like to hear more on this subject from Kingsley Bolton, he'll be talking on World Englishes in the Global Context. This is the inaugural Braj and Yamuna Khatru Distinguished Lecture in the Linguistic Sciences. He'll be giving his talk on it's at 7:30 in the evening on Thursday, October 9th, 210 Illini Union. Anyone interested should feel welcome to attend. And we want to thank him and also thank Yamuna Khatru. She's Emerita Professor of Linguistics here at the U of I. Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much for having us.